You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
The Coaches Network.
Hey guys, you're now listening to the Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy.
Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name's Coach Yas, and I've got a very special guest with me today. My guest today is Jeremy Snape. Good morning, Jeremy. How are you?
Hi, Yas. Good to see you.
Brilliant. Jeremy, just for the listeners that maybe aren't familiar with yourself and who you are and what you do, would you mind maybe just sharing a bit about that?
Yeah, a bit of a varied background, really. I started as a professional cricketer. So for 19 years, I was a journeyman pro, not the superstar, but played in three county teams, Northants, Gloucestershire, really successful Gloucestershire side, and then a Leicester team that won some 2020s as well. So won about 8 trophies, had the chance to play for England 11 times. And yeah, I was probably known for my innovative style. I was the world's slowest bowler, so not a great claim to fame. But I loved it, you know, and it taught me a huge amount about myself and my mindset. Some days I felt, you know, I was really strong and confident and I could dominate the opposition. And I did that. I got man of the match on my England debut. And then other days I felt like, you know, I was nervous. I felt, you know, the pressure got to me before I even, you know, got off the team bus and played poorly. So I became fascinated about psychology. And then I did a master's degree in sports psychology with a view to really trying to decode this stuff around mindset and turn it into a practical toolkit for elite performers. And that's, you know, been incredible, really. I worked with Shane Warne in the Indian Premier League when that started and we won the first tournament. Coached South Africa cricket as they went from number 4 to number 1 in the world. Worked with the LMA in football, looking after the leadership development of the top guys there. And also worked with Eddie Jones with England Rugby. So I've had a background in different sports and working with different coaches and performers. And then part of my job and my podcast through Sporting Edge is to sort of interview those people and capture the insights of these world-class thinkers and performers. And then I do a lot of consulting into coach education and also, you know, corporate companies as well. So, yeah, it's a pretty varied career, but I guess it all centers around trying to help people to think and perform at their best. And that's not always easy, especially when you get to the top of your field, because often, you know, we get on our own way and the pressure becomes a derailer. So we might make a nice, clear plan on a flip chart somewhere, but it's often the pressure that gets to us. And when we learn those strategies to be able to think clearly, then, you know, we're off to a good start.
Amazing. There's a lot to unpack there. Loads of juices flowing for me. First of all, you know, you talked there about your own journey and becoming fascinated with the mindset. What was it about the mindset that really piqued your interest? When was the first time that you thought, you know, actually there's something going on here? I need to figure out what it is.
Yeah, it's a good question. I was always curious about it because, you know, you get some players in a, you know, cricket dressing room that are either technically brilliant or really gifted in terms of their talent, and they seem to go through life reasonably easily. I found it a real struggle. And although I had a good career, it was a bit of a battle, and the battle was me against myself, really. You know, as much as I played against the best players in the world, often the biggest opponent was in my head. So there was a particular game playing for England in India with 120,000 people in the stadium. You know, England were desperate to win this game. The pressure was building up, and I ran out Freddie Flintoff, our only hope of winning the game, which wasn't my smartest move. But I was left in this stadium, which was six times bigger than any sort of stadium I'd played in front of before. And I just had that massive negative voice in my head saying, you've really messed it up here. You can't win from this position. You know, the press are going to, you know, crucify you and stuff. And actually, I was starting to think about the consequences of failure and forgot to watch the next ball. You know, and our brain does that. We start to think about self-preservation or the, you know, what's going to happen. So, you know, I did a master's degree then and started to learn more about sports psychology. This episode in India was back in sort of 2001. So sports psychology was big in the States, but not really in the UK. And, you know, we might have team building sessions with a psychologist every pre-season, but it wasn't integrated as part of our coaching and sort of skill development. And I just thought it was a massive opportunity because I was a bright, hardworking cricketer. And if I couldn't get it right, then, you know, everyone must need some kind of support. And as we've seen, I think, you know, psychology is the next frontier, really. I think we've had a decade of fitness, a decade of analytics, and now we need to start looking at things that we can't measure with a, you know, skin fold calipers or a, you know, a microchip in your shirt like Prozone, you know. So for me, that sort of inner game is critical, and it's been a real privilege to both play at the top level and understand it myself, because as I was going through my master's degree, I started to sort of deploy some of these strategies around focus and concentration under pressure. And actually I hit the winning runs in a 2020 final, which was incredibly tense in one of the big tournaments in the UK. And that was almost like redemption for me, that before that I was scattered, panicked, my mind was cast forward and I was thinking about consequences. Yet when I'd learned these mental skills in that moment of winning this game, I wasn't actually thinking about winning, although I knew it was burning brightly and I could hear the crowd. It was almost dulled down and I was focused on my own processes, my own breathing, my own instincts. And actually I played one of the best shots ever to win the game, you know, so I've felt it and seen it myself, and then being able to coach people through that and see them thrive is a privilege, really. And yeah, so I think we all get in our own way at, you know, at times in our career, whether it's sport or business or whatever. And I think if we can learn these mental skills, it's incredibly liberating.
Definitely. I guess the word that kind of really jumps out at me as you're talking through there is, or the phrase is, being present. And I think that's the real key thing that jumps out for me. It kind of, for me, even in my own coaching, I agree with you in the sense that, you know, we're going through a transitional phase and we're kind of now going into that phase where at this, yeah, I think the psychological aspect of things is actually getting a lot more attention, and it probably needs to be even more attention than it is getting at the moment, even though it is increasing gradually, to the point where even when I'm coaching with my players and my athletes, and I'm often kind of got to a point where I'm no longer really talking about the technical stuff. I'm no longer really talking about the tactical stuff. I'm now thinking, right, as an individual now, can you focus on being present? Can you pay attention to what's happening, how you're feeling, and not just physically, but emotionally as you're going through whatever it is that you're going through? So if you're playing that pass, when you've found it to be a good or effective decision, what was you going through? What were the emotions you were feeling? How were you feeling physically? How did it feel, you know, literally physiologically? What was that like? And I think it's really, I've certainly seen a very different result in the impact I've had with the players that I'm working with now with that approach. So I guess, you know, something you touched on earlier, you talk about, yeah, we, you know, there is this mindset piece and we all do have this element of psychology within us, but we all react and do so in different ways. But also, like you said, you can't get the skin for calibers and measure this. So although you can't measure it, how are you trying to measure it?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't think we're in that position yet. I mean, through Sporting Edge, we've actually developed a winning mindset profile and program. And, you know, there's sort of six key factors that we've seen. I think the elite performers definitely have, you know, a goal and a drive. It's almost like they can see their vision of where they want to get to in Technicolor. They imagine that, you know, what will people be saying about me when I'm on a, you know, Premier League squad, or when I've won a gold medal, or when I've lost this weight, or when I've qualified with this degree? What will that make me feel like, and what will others see me as? I think there's something at an identity level that they, it's not just setting a goal and leaving it there. Then I think they've got this ability to create a structure and a routine and a rhythm that brings in these high performance habits. You know, even the elite performers, their motivation ebbs and flows. You know, they're not always going to be fizzing, getting out of bed to do the shuttle runs and the training. So there's definitely a sort of a drive and a determination in there, and a focus, because you can't put all your energy into everything. You've got to split it down into the things that are going to make most difference. Then I think there's this ability to perform under pressure we've spoken about, you know, being able to control your mind, being able to control your breathing, being able to control your physiology so that you can stay in the moment at those key points. And there's probably something about learning as well. The people that I've interviewed and seen thrive at the top level are, no matter how good they are, they've got this humility and curiosity to see how good they can be. And they'll always take risks and try and innovate and move forward. And then I think all of that has got to be wrapped up in well-being, you know, this idea of looking after yourself and, you know, nutrition and hydration and sleep. The recovery aspects, I think, of our well-being are underplayed, because we tend to focus on what's going to make me look good, what can I achieve during my working hours, what impact can I make. But actually, if we're not recovering as hard as we're working, then, you know, we erode our ability to perform through the week, and Friday ends up being half as good as Monday. But if we focus on our recovery, we can keep that sort of tempo going through the week. So those are some of the factors that I think, you know, give the winning mindset, and it can be different for everyone. That's why I keep those factors quite broad, because, you know, an executive going in to do a pitch to investors, you know, a young footballer taking a penalty in a Euros final, or a young mum taking the baby into town for the first day, they all, you know, have those mental traps and sort of concerns. And I think if we can stay focused and have those sort of goals in place, then we can get through those days all the same.
No, that's really interesting to hear. And I guess I want to come back to the first two factors you talked about, the identity profile, and then the vision and the goals that the athlete may have. I'm really curious to find out more about, are you measuring that from a perspective of what the athlete themselves or the individual themselves has been able to come up with, or the outcome of that with the support of other people, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, it depends, as we've obviously got a lot of different people listening to this episode. And, you know, if you're working at the junior level, then you're going to be much more directive, you're going to be much more prescriptive, and you're going to show people the model of what success looks like. And you need to be doing these things. You need to be sitting in these kind of profile bands to be a successful performer, whatever it is. So we're pretty much instructing them in how to go about it. Then at the elite level, it's much more about questioning and getting them to open up their awareness. And I think at the top level, we've got to give people an input, not only to the strategic goals, but also the tactical goals. So do you think this is possible for you this season? You know, what do you see? Get them to open up and see what they aspire to be, because that's where the motivation is going to come from. Who are their role models? Who inspires them? How do they play? You know, who do you want to be like? And then the second thing is, how are we going to build a plan, almost like a performance partnership with your coach, to say, how can I help you to get there? I'm going to need to support you. I'm going to need to challenge you. But it's important that we both agree on this so that we can stick to it when times get tough. the challenge is, if I set all your goals for you and I tell you how to do it, when your motivation wanes or when you have a setback or when something doesn't work, you're going to say, well, that was his plan anyway. So we need to have that emotional sort of engagement in the plan to make it really successful in tough times.
No, I think that's a really good point. And it just brings me back to a conversation I had a few months ago with Shaquille O'Neal, and he talked about Phil Jackson and how impactful he was on his journey. And that time with the Lakers, Phil Jackson never really got involved too much when it came to game day. He just, you know, if there was a situation, he'd often, you know, the players would be left, figure it out. We've done all the work. We've had all these conversations. We've done all the background work, but now you're in the situation. It's up to you to figure it out. And I think a really key thing, what you've just touched on there, is the importance of, I guess, the person or the individual involved having a sense of ownership around that development process. So that goal is not just, I'm the coach, I'm setting it for you. Because at the end of the day, I need to know what you want to achieve from this as well, as much as identify what I need you to achieve in order for us to get success together, if that makes sense. So I guess one of the things you touched on there, though, was find out what they see as the vision. What's their vision? Now, in some cases, would it be fair to say that actually, as much as it's good about finding out what they want to see, it's also maybe, like you said, they use the word challenge to maybe stretch their thinking around some of the things that they might be aware of, they might be conscious of, but they don't see as realistic outcomes for themselves, if that makes sense. So they might be seeing, all right, this is the vision that I've got, but this is only the vision I've got because I've got a limiting belief that's stopping me from seeing that this vision could be more, although I know the more exists, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, we're all trying to grow awareness, grow, passion and hunger to chase down those improvements. That's what we're all here to do as coaches. It sort of, we've got to challenge people in different ways. Some people, you say they can't do it and they try and prove you wrong and you knew that was what you were doing in the first place. Other people, you say, well, he or she's doing it, look how they do it. I bet you couldn't do that, what they're doing, because it shows that it's already been done because they're doing it, and they then try and copy it in their own way. Or you say, you know, let's pick the three people who you think are most aspirational. Yeah, who do you want to be like? You know, I want to be like Lionel Messi, or I want to be like, you know, whoever, Tom Brady or whatever, whichever sport you're in. And you pick out, okay, let's break down their skills. What do they do? Right, well, you know, his throw is absolutely incredible. Right, well, what's he doing? Well, his technique, his training, his strength, his balance, his decision-making, the space that he gets, those are the key things which allow Tom Brady to be exceptional. Okay, right, so there are six factors. Let's now work on those six factors. So we need to give you that space on the field. We need to review your decision-making. You need to slow down and feel like you've got that time. We're going to have a training program that gives you that balance and that power. And we're going to work with the accuracy of your throw or whatever it might be. So you've gone from this watching somebody on TV and thinking they're untouchable to breaking the components down into something that we can all, you know, if I'm 2 out of 10 compared to Tom Brady in terms of decision making, well, that's a developmental path. If I'm, you know, 4 out of 10 in terms of my strength and conditioning and balance, well, that's a development path. And if you're in a professional setup, you'll have an ologist looking after each of those paths. But even for a young athlete, we can say, you know, what's your communication like on the pitch out of 10? What's your movement into space like out of 10? You know, what's your leadership like on the pitch? What's your pass accuracy like out of 10? Well, at the moment, I think they're, you know, 3, 4. Okay, great. Well, over the next few weeks, we're going to do some drills in training. So then, you know, what the worst thing we can do is get kids to rock up to training and they don't understand how what we're going to do in the next hour relates to my personal development and our team strategy. So this is where you say, you know, hey, Mark, you know, this is that thing we spoke about. This is that pass accuracy drill. I'm going to be looking at you in this next session, especially because this is one of your, you know, key drivers that we've spoken about. All of a sudden, they then tune in to a different level. They know that's for them. But of course, their pass accuracy in the midfield gives you, you know, better possession of the ball and helps you to make transitions better. So, you know, I think just taking a step back away from the bibs and the cones and the, you know, drills to weave it into each individual's personal development plan before you go into each session. That's a really nice way of almost gluing them into that process of development.
No, I think it's a great point. I guess just on that then, you talk about obviously identifying maybe some of those areas you've identified, broken down those components. We use Tom Brady as an example there. And I think it's a great way to look at it, because often, you know, I mentioned off this, you know, some of the stuff that I do away from here is obviously coach education, working with coaches and on that aspect of things. And one of the biggest challenges I've come across with, certainly in the grassroots communities, is that I don't want to generalize, but that maybe the lack of attention to detail and actually breaking those things down. So I remember, I remember a particular instance where I had a learner who was on my course, and he was explaining to me, right, I want the team to press better. Okay, fine. So talk me through the situation. And he says, right, they were pressing, but they weren't pressing in the way that he wanted them to press. So I says, well, what did you do about it? Because, well, I told them they have to press properly. Okay, well, what does that look like? What does press properly mean? Do you understand that if this is a bowl of, I don't know, spag bowl, what it took to create that spag bowl in the way it ended up looking? And if you can't understand how the process that it took to get to that spag bowl, how the hell can you tell someone else to?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Get there, because they don't even know what they're looking at, let alone you've got the picture of the spag bowl, but they haven't got that. So telling them press properly isn't going to change everything, but what you've just kind of described there, instead of breaking down those components, is obviously going to be really key. But another bit of what you mentioned there was that getting their perspective and their perception of what those things are. So how is their communication, how is their leadership, and how is that, how much of that can we leave completely up to them, in the sense that, is it their perception? And are you saying that then we can maybe throw in, right, okay, well, that might be your perception of things, but do we now get them to go to the point where they're actually having to bring rationale, justification and evidence for their perspective, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think all the time we're trying to grow somebody's self-awareness. So, you know, you may have somebody saying, oh, I think my leadership's 8 out of 10. And you go, oh, really? Okay. So one way of doing it is, you know, ask the other players around, what do you think of Mark's leadership on the pitch out of 10? And they'll score it 3. So that's, you know, an interesting discussion. And then you might say, relative to Cristiano Ronaldo, how's your leadership? Are you still an 8? You know, and it's the reference points you use that make them just think, well, maybe I'm not an 8. And say, well, okay, so if, and again, this is where you can get into loads of detail. What does great leadership on the pitch look like? What are the 5 components of that, or 3 components of that? Right, so where are you on each of those? Body language, communication, presence, you know, before the game, after the game, where are you? I didn't hear you say anything at halftime, and you're an 8 out of 10 leader. So you know, you're just trying to chip away and give them a very realistic starting point. And your example about the press, you know, I was visualizing in my head as you were speaking, you know, you could show one of the best teams in the world a 5-minute video of them pressing brilliantly. And you just get the players to watch it and say, tell me what you see. We're going to watch this for 5 minutes. Let's get some key things. What do you actually see the players doing? Because this is where we've got to move from theory to actually physical behaviors that we can measure. So then we say, right, I've seen them do these 3 things. And then we show some footage of them playing on Saturday in an amateur game. You know, we've got a dodgy bit of handycam footage on someone's iPhone or whatever. And we say, how does this relate? Oh, well, these guys weren't in a line. Okay, great. So that's the first thing. We've got to be in a line. How do we get in a line? Well, we need to be communicating and, you know, looking at the ball and then looking to the side. Okay, really? That's great. So why don't we do a drill that sets that up? And all of a sudden, you've broken down this intangible, ethereal, aspirational thing of pressing brilliantly, which is gobbledygook to most people. Because it's like when we hear in the corporate world, we've got to be more agile. Mm. What does that? What do you want me to do? Just walk into the office and change direction four times? And unless you break it down into the actual behaviors and show me what is it, you know, how do I behave to be agile? How do I behave to press? How do I behave to be a leader? Show me those things. And then if I've got two or three key things, not more than that, because it's too confusing. And then say, I'm going to watch you this Saturday, Mark. And I'm going to say, you know, how are you getting on with your leadership? Let's take you from a 3 out of 10 to a 5 out of 10 this week. Mm. And let's see, you tell me what you think and I'll tell you what I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. There's two key things that kind of come up for me. That piece around perception and reference at the right point. Where you talked about, right, you might be a 3 out of 10, but then now how are you in comparison to Barcelona? I've actually used that type of approach before, where I might have a session with a group of players and, right, you know, based on what you've just done in the last 10, 15, 20 minutes, however much it's been, how would you rate your passing out of 10? And say, oh, yeah, it's a 6 or 7. I'll say, all right, okay, 6 or 7. So, all right, what would take it to an 8 or a 9 then? They start telling me some of these things and we do it again. And then they say, well, we've done the things that we said we're going to do. So are you telling me now that you're at an 8 or a 9, are you? It's no right or wrong. It's just perception. And it's just understanding of perspectives. And they say, yeah, okay, well, how do we get to a 10? And then this is where I kind of hit them with a bit more perspective and say, right, so you're saying now that if you did this, you'd be as good as Barcelona, because we've maybe had a prior conversation and said, well, Barcelona are a 10. So you're that close from being away from Barcelona, are you? And then I kind of just pegs them back. All right, now let's look back at where we started. Were you really a 5 or a 6? Actually, probably not. We're probably about a 3 or a 2. Okay, fine. There's nothing wrong with that, because it's about developing the awareness, like you said. It's about raising an understanding of, right, this is where we're actually starting from and this is where we're trying to end up. And then the second piece, you know, you talk there about the drills that we're going to develop for the players and develop for the athletes. In those pieces there then, now this is, before I get to that, you talk there about breaking down those components, having two or three things that we can kind of now focus on as tangible things. Now, the way when I work, I like to use the idea of these green light moments is what I like to refer to them as. And I almost like use like a traffic light system. Now, we've identified the things that are going to have an impact here. We're going to identify maybe some of the behaviors that we need to carry out. But now we need to assess and decide on when the right time is to apply them. So there's going to be some moments where, if I use the analogy of crossing a road, where actually the light's still green for the cars and it's red for me. But if I do enough observation, I can check that it's probably still safe for me to cross that road. There's going to be other times that might not be the case. Now, if I'm behind the wheel now, and that light is in front of me is green, I know that, okay, because it's green, it's a likelihood that it's going to go from a green to an amber. So I can already prepare for the potential outcome of that and vice versa. Whereas if I approach the light at an amber, not knowing wherever it's come from, that gives me a different problem and different observations need to be made. So I guess you have to assess the risk factor of when these things have happened. So you've got the 5-minute video of this team press, and we picked up some of the variables that we've observed. But the next step is, right, okay, well, you've observed this. Can you tell me more about when this happened and get them to really develop a deeper understanding around that? And then I guess brings me on to the next question around, you talk about preparing the drills for the players and practices for the players. And this is something that I've kind of gone full circle on, or I say full circle on, but I've gone from one end of the spectrum to the other one. For when I first started coaching, I wouldn't mind doing a lot of unopposed work and stuff that I would consider that lacks context to the real situation. Whereas now a lot more of my stuff is not necessarily games, but even if I had to do an unopposed practice now, I'm very conscious about developing and understanding and building context for the athletes. So if me and you could be passing back and forth over a 10-yard distance now, I might just say, right, there's no context there. So I might turn and say, right, Jeremy, I want you to imagine that you're a centre forward, but there's a centre back on your left shoulder. I want you to receive as if that's the situation. Straight away, okay, still might be unopposed, but you've now got a different picture in your mind as to what that looks like. Now, how much of that would you say is relevant, or would you say is actually more from your experience and observations that it's probably more beneficial just to keep it opposed?
Well, I think, again, it's difficult to go into a specific sport and a specific skill, but I think what you're looking to do is get the awareness first. Mm. And what you're looking to do when we're asking them about, you know, how do you think your press is compared to Barcelona or something, we're not trying to shame them. Mm. We're just trying to get them to have a realistic starting point. And they will generally overscore themselves because, A, they don't want to look stupid and they don't want to, they think they're better than they are. And then the second reason they overscore themselves is because they are fearful of making the mistakes in the development stage to get to 8 out of 10. Mm. So they're worried about what you're going to do to them if they say they're 3 out of 10. Mm. So I think that tells you something about the way the training's got to be built up to say, okay, let's take that awareness onto the field now. So you, it may be that you start unopposed. You know, again, this is this sort of skill development hierarchy. Maybe that you start unopposed. You know, it may be that then you bring in your context of we're still unopposed, but now we've got some context. Mm. So in cricket, that might be, okay, you've got this kind of bowler, you've got these many runs to win off the last over. You know, I'm still throwing at you. It's not a live game. It's the coach throwing balls. But you now have a sort of an intensity level or a context or a area you're trying to hit it so that you've got a bit more game plan to it. And then you advance up to the next level, which is, you know, opposed and trying to replicate it there with all the movement and pressure, you know, and sort of banter that goes with that kind of situation. Another example that sprung to mind was when I was coaching the South African cricket team. They are used to dry, hard, bouncy conditions in South Africa. And they came over to England in grey, drizzly, wet conditions. And for those who don't follow cricket, obviously, when the ball pitches on the floor on a sort of slightly green grass wicket, it can really deviate. So they needed to get used to that very quickly. So the first test match of the series when they came over was really, really important. So we got to the first training ground at Headingley in Yorkshire. The guys got off the bus, they got changed, they went out onto the field, they did a few laps of the physio, they got into the nets and the fast bowlers started running in. They got a brand new ball, the top batsman went in to bat in the nets. And after two balls, I blew a whistle and sort of stopped the practice and said, okay, guys, just come in a second. Batsman, bowlers, come on in. What have you learned? And they just looked at me as if I'd gone mad. They were just sort of, you know, getting their bodies loose, getting into it, getting a feel for it. And I said, well, you've had two balls. You know, you've faced two, the bowlers have bowled two balls. So you should know whether it's swinging or not, this particular ball that you've got, because they're all slightly different. You should know what the pitch is like in terms of speed and bounce and where you need to hit the pitch to be effective. And batsmen, you should know the pace of the pitch, whether the ball's swinging, what your movement patterns need to be like, and what your game, what shots are on and what shots are off. You face two balls. And all I was really trying to do was an extreme example of, are you switched on in this practice? Are you really taking it in, or are you just going through the motions and hoping that after 20 minutes of sort of mindless practice, you've improved as a player? So I think going back to that pressing situation, it may be, you know, we've just watched Barcelona. We've talked about it unopposed. We've talked about it one-to-one. You know, we've got into it. Blow the whistle. Out of 10, how do you think we're getting on with those three things we spoke about? Communication, alignment, and movement. We haven't moved, really. We haven't been together. Okay, great. So let's stop and let's go again. You know, you're trying to bring that awareness onto the pitch and then build it up and obviously praise it when you see it. Because, you know, I've worked in Premier League soccer teams where the sort of strategy meetings are, you know, the sort of metal magnets sort of sitting on the board. You're going to move here, you're going to press, you're going to go out wide, you're going to cut inside. And it's all a bit confusing. We go out on the pitch and it's almost like they can't visualize that again now. So we need to bring that onto the pitch in terms of spatial awareness. So I think building it up in those stages is the best way to do it. And again, you know, we've got a big variation between what you can do with professional Premier League players and what you can do with under 12s, you know, juniors. So I think that, you know, whoever's listening, you need to sort of scale that to whichever level. But awareness and getting the players to understand what you're saying, you know, slow down and get them to understand stage one and stage two first. Don't rush them on showing them what Barcelona do and expect them to do. It's just not going to work. Everyone will get frustrated and you'll end up having to go back to basics anyway.
Mm. No, really interesting that. And I think, you know, you're absolutely right. I think as part of that winning mindset piece, self-awareness and awareness around not just stuff that's happening on the field or off the field, I think it's just as important. So I guess in addition to the awareness piece, what would you say are the other key components that really tie up and I guess a winning mindset is dependent on? And from your experiences, is there any consistencies or inconsistencies that exist when it comes to elite sport? Or do you think actually, you know, there's a set, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, there's loads. We could do hours talking about it. I mean, I've spent, you know, 20 years exploring this, but I think one of the key things that every elite performer will have to face, and we've just seen it with England in the Euros, is setbacks. You know, we're going to have players that don't get picked. They're on the bench. They get injured. They miss a penalty. They fall out with a coach. They move clubs and it doesn't work. You know, there's going to be all these different setbacks in your career and in your life. And I think what we have to do is make sure that we process the setback effectively from a psychological point of view, because they're going to be key building blocks in the future, because we'll always look back at these memories. So if we've coded it as a catastrophic moment, then we'll never be able to move on from it. So the worst people after setbacks see this as all of me. I've gone from being a brilliant footballer to a crap bloke. You know, I'm just a rubbish person now because I missed that penalty. They see it as something that's fixed that can never be changed. That's just the way it is now. That's my identity. I'm a loser. Whereas the people who are brilliant after setbacks say that was a specific skill. So the way I put the ball down and the way I walked back to my mark after that, before I kicked the penalty, I wasn't even clear where I was going to kick it. I was not focused. I hadn't picked a target. So that's something that I can definitely do better, that skill. It's something that I can definitely practice and improve. So it's not fixed and it doesn't permeate into the rest of my life. I can still be a brilliant son, friend, husband, you know, daughter, whatever it might be. Just because I missed a penalty doesn't make me a bad person. So I think there's sort of three key elements there, that sort of specific time, specific skill, and, you know, that ability to change and grow through life and learn from it is another key element of the winning mindset, for sure.
Definitely. And I think, again, the term that really kind of just jumps out at me as you're talking is, what can you control? Focus on that. Focus on what you can control. You can't control what's happened. You can't control what people think about you. You can't control any of those things. What you can control is your mindset or your approach to things, your behaviors and your actions. And I think that's key. So I guess, you know, just as we look to kind of wind down then, Jeremy, what would you say are some of the key things that coaches maybe listening to this, or even potential athletes listening to this, could do to start adopting more of a winning mindset? Where do they start? What are some of the questions that they start asking themselves to try to, I guess, get that ball rolling and see where we're on the right track?
I think we need to get people to see that they can always improve. You know, I've worked with some of the world's top performers and they're always looking to improve. You know, if you think you're going to stay at the top of your game by being the same player, you're mistaken, because the better you get, the opposition are watching you. Or they're trying to expose all your weaknesses and limit your strength. So you've got to keep adapting. If you're going to be a top player for 10 years, you need to be 10 different players. So that's the mindset that we need. And as a coach, we probably need to be 10 different coaches over that period. So innovation and change are critical. So the key thing is, what do I need to do now to be successful? You know, where am I heading? So there's that growth sort of pathway. Then we need to take away the fear of failure. You know, you might get a little bit worse. You might have a few tough games. If we're playing out from the back, we might concede a goal, you know, in this period. But do we believe genuinely that this is the right way to play? Well, if it is, then we're going to commit to it over a 6-week period and we're going to really train every day to make sure we get better. And if we see those improvements, let's make sure we're really positively reinforcing all the hard work that's gone in. So I suppose we're trying to praise character, resilience, risk-taking, courage, you know, being open to feedback, being selfless in the team. Those are the kind of characteristics I'd love to praise, rather than somebody scoring a screamer top left. You know, that's sort of an outcome that came from something that you may never be able to repeat again. But character, resilience, selflessness, great communication, being willing to try, being coachable, those are all the things that I think if we coach those things and praise them and dial them up, we get a brilliant, fertile environment for everyone to thrive, and the rest of it takes care of itself.
Amazing. And I think that's top, and I guess I definitely relate to some of those principles there in terms of the work I try and do with the athletes I work with. Jeremy, I'm really conscious of time. First of all, I want to thank you for obviously being with me this morning. I really enjoyed that. And I'm sure there's, like you said, there's probably hours and hours of conversation that we could still have on these topics. But for any of the listeners that maybe are interested in finding a little bit more about what we've discussed today or more about what you do, is there somewhere they can get in touch with you or to see that work?
Yeah, sure. The podcast is called Inside the Mind of Champions. That's 5-star rated on Apple. And sportingedge.com is where our video library of the 100 experts that we've interviewed sit. So we've got a membership club there where everyone can join and have access to all the videos and insights that we've got from the world's best athletes and thought leaders. So yeah, we've got a great community there and more than happy to welcome some of your coaches from around the world into it. So yeah, sportingedge.com and Inside the Mind of Champions is the podcast.
Brilliant. And just a final question then for you. Just by sitting here having this conversation with me, you've made yourself part of the Coaches Network. What's the one key message that you want to leave with everyone?
Make sure that the psychological element of what you coach is at the forefront, because without that, none of the technical and tactical elements that you'll try and implement will work. If people are fearful, feel like they're being judged, you know, then they won't learn. We've got to make people feel safe. We've got to get them to understand the skill. We've got to give them the confidence to deploy those skills at the right time in the right way. If we do that, you'll transform the players you're working with.
Amazing. Again, thank you very much for your time, Jeremy. I really appreciate that.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.